This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Mike Canary. Later this hour, I'll sit down with Dr. Francis Jensen, author of the best-selling book, The Teenage Brain, A Neuroscientist's Survival Guide to Raising Adolescents and Young Adults. It explores new research into the function and development of the adolescent brain, especially in the context of things like learning, multitasking, stress, sleep, and addiction. But first, Naples resident and best-selling novelist Nathan Hill is back in the studio. It's time to discuss a lecture series he's presenting at Florida Gulf Coast University that's exploring how the technological innovations of the 21st century have influenced the art and craft of writing. Nathan Hill's debut novel, The Nix, was named the number one book of the year by Audible and Entertainment Weekly, as well as one of the year's best books by The New York Times, Washington Post, NPR, Slate, Amazon, and many others. The Nix was winner of the LA Times Book Prize for First Fiction. It's been published worldwide in 30 languages. Hill's nonfiction has appeared in Wired, ESPN, The Magazine, and The New York Times Book Review. His short stories have been published in many literary journals. But today we're going to chat about why he thinks the 21st century is an exciting time to be a writer. Nathan Hill, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you very much.
And this part of today's show is pre-taped, so we're not taking calls. But if you would like to add your thoughts via social media, you can find us on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So why is the 21st century a particularly exciting time to be a writer?
Well, it's if not exciting, definitely weird. There's just a lot of things going on. Tonight's lecture, for example, is going to be about some of the utopian promises of the 90s regarding digital literature and hypertext and why none of those utopias really came true, and other directions for kind of electronic literature. I've always been interested in technology. Like even when I was a young man, I remember one Christmas where I told my parents, and they were shocked about this. I told my parents that I was going to do all my Christmas shopping on something called Amazon, which they had never heard of.
But how long ago that would have been?
That must have been mid 90s, late 90s, something like that. I was always interested in technology, in the web. When I was in my 20s, I learned how to write HTML code just by hand, not using any kind of software to help me out. And when I was in grad school, I did a lot of work with hypertext and hypermedia and interactive design. So I've always kind of been interested in this. But this lecture series is really about how what these kinds of technologies can teach us about the writing of literature, and whether there's any kind of crossover, whether it's possible to take the traditions that grew up in the print book, the Gutenberg's codex book, whether you can take any of those traditions and whether they translate online. So that's partly what I'm talking about tonight.
With hypertext, excuse me, I have a frog in my throat. With the hypertext, just so people are clear, because we don't really think about it anymore. It used to be if you said hypertext, it'd be like, ooh, that's that innovative way you can click on something and go somewhere else, which is basically like how the internet works and how Wikipedia works, but it never really made it very far into fiction or anything like that.
For anybody who was born, say after 1995, it's hard to remember just how exciting the hyperlink was as a concept. In the late 90s, when it became possible to, instead of reading a book in a kind of sequential chronological order that an author sort of predetermined, suddenly you can take all of these different nodes of text and kind of shuffle them together and connect them with all these hyperlinks. And suddenly a new kind of reading was born where you could, click on something and it would take you to a different and maybe associated part of the story and click on something else. And so instead of learning a story kind of sequentially, chronologically, suddenly a story started to accrete meaning kind of associatively. And it was just a different way to understand literature. And it was all very, very exciting. I mean, there was a cover story in the New York Times Book Review in 1992 declaring the end of the book, that that hypertext would one day replace the book as the way we would read literature, which, of course, did not come to pass.
Do you know if the Choose Your Own Adventure series ever tried digital? Because that's sort of, that's where I would immediately think to in terms of the place where those places meet.
Yeah, and I loved those books when I was a kid.
Me too.
I mean, I grew up on Choose Your Own Adventure books, and they were very kind of early and primitive kind of hypertext, just without the hyperlink. I do recall that a lot of those old Choose Your Own Adventure books were eventually republished in a standalone app. And I remember you know, downloading the app and reading some of them, and it's kind of being sad that I did, because you know, you can never go back again. You can't go back home again. You know, like they were the same books that were so transportive in my youth suddenly seemed kind of juvenile to me now.
Have you seen the – I just heard an interview. I haven't watched it yet, but apparently there's a new Black Mirror episode that's come out that is interactive in that same way.
Yeah, Bandersnatch. It's a choose-your-own-adventure movie.
How does that relate to what you're talking about in terms of narrative structure and what people can get out of stories if they have their own, you know, ability to change the story?
Well, the real question is whether readers, or in this case with Netflix, you know, viewers, whether we really want that or not. I know in the 90s, some of the big utopian claims about hypertext was that a reader-centric literature would be more freeing, that a reader was free to follow her own path down a story. And there's questions of whether we really want that or not. I mean, it's possible that we really like the aesthetic and curated experience that an author or a filmmaker can give us, that we can sit down for 2 hours and watch a movie sequentially, and we don't really need to find our own way through that movie. And further, like in the case of literature, there's questions on whether, you know, if a screen has too many links, does it make it more difficult to read? Since the 90s, there have been all these really interesting, you know, neuroscience studies showing that the more links on a page, the less you actually cognitively kind of keep in your head in terms of the content. You know, you start seeing the links instead of what the words mean.
Ah.
Yeah. And so a lot of the early hypertext authors really didn't have a firm grasp on what happens when you put text online and when you cover it with those blue links, which is reasonable. I mean, it was a new technology. But as we learn more and more about what our eyes and brains do as we're looking at screens, it becomes more and more clear that it's very difficult to translate literature to that medium.
Hmm. You know, I'm thinking of Wikipedia, you know, where you can kind of go down the rabbit hole, as it were, and wind up in all kinds of crazy places. And, of course, that's not being directed by any author. It's just sort of organically sprung up.
Yeah, and Wikipedia is a great example of a really effective hypertext. And the question is whether an aesthetic experience like the one you get from reading a great novel can be translated to hypertext. Hypertext is obviously great for nonfiction, for encyclopedia, and for academic research. It's very, very helpful. But is it artful? Can we have that kind of experience that we have with books, where we feel transported and emotionally sort of taken away?
We're going to get down the road a little bit on some of your other lectures here with this question, but is there anything analogous to reading text off of a piece of paper or a screen that's static in terms of we need to have intentionality in order to connect to it? Because everything else, it seems to me, there's at least some level of passivity to it. Is there – can you think of anything besides reading that has that same form?
I mean not offhand. I mean, and you're right. And even reading is sort of automatic at times. You know, you think about reading we have a name for books that are very easy and quick to read. It's the beach read, right? And those are novels that are meant to be very, you know, processed very, very quickly. And there are some really interesting studies where people wear electrodes on their heads to record an EEG, an electroencephalograph, of what's happening while they're reading. And it shows that the more predictable and easy the syntax, the sentence structure, the language in a piece of reading, the faster they read and the kind of lower amplitude there are of certain electrical impulses in the brain associated with semantic processing and predictive networks. But when you give those same readers, when you give them a sentence that makes no sense, you know, you see the brain trying to process the errors. And then when you have something in between, a sentence, let's say like something Shakespearean, something very beautiful, a turn of phrase, an evocative metaphor, you see all this interesting other stuff, electrical activity happening in the brain, and the reader slows down, and there's this kind of what they call a repair process, where you try to figure out what that turn of phrase means. And that's sort of the magic area for writers. That's where you want to be. You want people
it's like engagement.
Exactly. You don't want people skimming the surface, just kind of reading as fast as they can, because then they're not really kind of fully, their brains even aren't really fully engaging with the text. You want them to slow down enough that they really engage and reflect on what's happening in the text. And the way to do that is with interesting language.
You know, I read a nonfiction book by a I guess he's a computer scientist named Stephen Wolfram. He's the guy behind Wolfram Alpha, mm-hmm. and that's the engine behind Siri. He wrote a book 15 years ago called A New Kind of Science, and it was about the philosophy of doing science digitally, I guess would be a way to put it. But I read the first chapter, and it was so heavy but so engaging mm-hmm. that I reread the first chapter, and then I read the second chapter. And then I reread the first chapter, and then I read the second chapter, and then wow. I read the third chapter. And I did went through the whole book that way.
I wish when I was a teacher, I wish some of my students would have had your work ethic.
Well, no, I just felt like he was really onto something different, and it's changed the way I look at a lot of things. But anyway, I digress. If you're just joining the show today, I'm talking with author Nathan Hill about his lecture series at Florida Gulf Coast University that looks at how the technological innovations of the 21st century have influenced the art and craft of writing. This segment is not live, so we're not taking phone calls, but you can engage with the show on social media. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So next Wednesday's lecture is going to be about video games and their potential for storytelling. Art, video games, storytelling, or what's the nexus there?
Well, all right. So there's basically two theories about storytelling in video games. And one theory is that, you know, that a video game tells a story much like a novel or a movie does, you know. And maybe you've played a kind of video game where there's some action for a while and then there's a cut scene where your characters kind of, you know, talk to each other. You're not controlling them at that point. You're just kind of watching the action as you would in a movie. And then the control of the character comes back to you, and then you go, you know, I don't know, beat up the bad guys for a while, and then there's another cutscene, and that's kind of interesting. And there's some really good stories available for in that format. But I'm kind of more interested in a different kind of narrative in the literature. It's called a ludonarrative, which is the kind of natural story that comes out of a game. Think of a game of tennis. Tennis is not a story. But if you watched the Australian Open final the other morning, a story emerged from the match.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah.
That wasn't there before. So there's something about engaging in a game, the playing of a game, that can create a story that didn't exist beforehand. It's not a framed narrative, but it's a ludo narrative, meaning a game.
Like chess. The story behind a chess game.
Exactly. There's no narrative there, but after the game is over, you can construct that narrative.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so that's what I'm kind of interested in, is the potential for video games to create those kinds of stories, and whether those stories could ever be aesthetically pleasing, whether those could ever be kind of an emotional experience like reading a good book or watching a good movie.
You know, I'm thinking of the rise of people watching people play video games.
Oh, my goodness.
there's the narrative there. I mean, you know, there are, you know, people have become characters and they are creating story arcs about their gameplay while making gameplay.
Absolutely. I mean, spending any time on Twitch
will
show you that – and this is incredibly, incredibly popular. In fact, it's the fastest growing – you know, esports is the fastest growing entertainment sports venue in the world right now. Watching people play video games is a really big deal.
I think there's more people watching people play video games in South Korea than there are people watching the NFL. I read that. I mean, that's like for real.
I think that might be true. I know that the former head of the NFL Network, the television network, recently went to Blizzard, a gaming company that makes Overwatch, and he's now the head of the Overwatch Esports League. And when I interviewed him about an article I wrote about that league for Wired magazine, he said that he used an old Wayne Gretzky quote that you should skate to where the puck is going to be,
right?
And he thinks that's where the puck is going to be, that he's getting out of the NFL and going into video games.
You know, I just heard apparently the NFL is running into, or football in general is running into, some problems with insurance. The insurance carriers are no longer willing to extend the coverage, and that may really cause problems. And I envision a future where there are gamers controlling robots on the field that can go as fast and hard as they want, and it's still humans controlling them. Can you know, stadiums full of people watching robots play football.
The interesting thing about video game sports is that the sport is necessarily going to have to evolve as the technology evolves. I mean, the early hypertext writers understood this, came to understand it. If you try to read some of the early hypertexts, unless you're using Netscape Navigator,
right,
you just can't. And so there's kind of a technological problem there. Video video game sports is kind of this has the same problem because video games, of course, iterate in the same way that technology does. And so unlike, let's say, baseball that hasn't fundamentally changed in 100 years, you have these technologies that are going to change and change and change. And so when I've talked to some of the makers of these video games, I mean, their opinion is that what you know, if in 20 years everybody's playing Overwatch with virtual reality headsets, then that's what Overwatch esports will be. And so that's going to be really interesting to watch is how these sports evolve as the technology evolves and whether they can keep their audience as they do so.
Are video games art?
I think some can be. Yeah, I think some can be. At least artful, and I know that there's a really great kind of indie game making community centered around this storytelling software called Twine, where you can make sort of interactive fiction games, and some of those games are really pretty interesting and try to be intentionally artful, but not of course in the same way as hypertext. Hypertext really came from a print background, and so it was really committed to kind of the I don't know, the kind of literary quality that you associate with novels. These new text games are trying to be games, but they're also trying to be art at the same time. So they're coming at it from a completely different perspective.
You know, Richard and I were chatting earlier today. He follows the video game world a lot more closely than I do, and he was interested in apparently Roger Ebert, the film critic, said that video games aren't art, and then that caused a controversy, and then there was a bill in New York that was going to basically make the labels for who can play what codified into law, and it was all kind of came down to that question of art or not art, because so have you given that much thought in terms of the implications of whether video games are legally considered art?
Well, I have thought about it, and mostly my conclusions are unsatisfying because it's just such a sticky wicket. It's you think about some of these video games, and I mean, I don't know. We usually associate art as the kind of production of one mind, the kind of communicative effort of a single person. But if you look at some of these AAA video game titles, like a Call of Duty, has been worked on by
1,000 artists.
Yeah, but so has any big movie, and we consider movies art.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so it's hard to say. Like, how much does it really matter that it's the production of one person? I mean, we give a director a lot of credit for making a movie, but really the director is just kind of the CEO of a massive corporation. And similarly, the writers and the directors of video games, is it their artistic production, or is it an accretion of the artistic production of everybody working under them? I don't know. That's an interesting question, and one that hasn't been fully satisfyingly answered. I know that I've had beautiful experiences with video games, and experiences that I think I would consider artful, that were at least as transporting as certain paintings I've seen in museums.
Yeah.
That doesn't necessarily mean that all video games are art, but I think some video games strive for that condition.
It's almost like art emerges, from a complex system emerges something greater than itself or something like that.
Yeah, and I mean, keep in mind, this is all still really, really new technology. As Marshall McLuhan wrote in The Medium as the Message, we understand new technology using the metaphors of the technology it replaces.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're still kind of using these old and maybe even outdated terms like art to describe this new thing. Maybe we give it another 100 years and it'll shake off the old metaphors and we'll see it for what it really is.
Fascinating. February 13th, I'm going to read this here. How literary fiction provides a simulation of real-world social relations that's helpful in navigating the real world.
Mm.
Translate that to it.
Well, there are all these interesting studies showing that the more people read literary fiction, the better they are at tasks involving empathy or theory of mind. Theory of mind is kind of the cognitive version of empathy. If empathy means you kind of you understand the emotions of another person, theory of mind is you understand their thinking, their perspective.
Put yourself in their shoes.
Exactly. And so it turns out that the more people read literary fiction, the better they are at things involving empathy and theory of mind. In other words, it helps you understand other people. And there are all these theories about why that might be. And one of the more persuasive ones to me is that literary literary fiction takes its subject. This is as opposed to like entertaining fiction, which is, you know, its subject is the, you know, like a spy solving a problem or thwarting a plot or whatever. It's for entertainment value. Literary fiction tends to take as its subject relationships between people. And it turns out that the more of these things you read, the better you are at navigating those kinds of relationships in real life, because fiction allows a sort of simulation. It's a simulation that runs on your brain of the real world. And provided that the author is writing it from a kind of psychologically realist point of view, then it becomes a kind of virtual reality where you can test various things out in your head rather than risking doing them in real life, if that makes sense.
You know, is there an analog here also in the video game world? You know, I'm thinking something like Second Life, or, you know, I don't know how many people are – I guess some people are still Second Lifing. But, you know, where you are, you know, living out a personality in real time with people who are real but elsewhere – and maybe it has that same sort of benefit when it comes to empathy.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I think people get that kind of pleasure from video games too. And if you need any, you know, if you need any proof about that, I mean, just go to any Comic-Con and look at the people dressed up as video game characters. You know, how important that kind of other identity is. In terms of fiction, I mean, in terms of literary fiction, the reason it's really helpful is instead of, you know, dressing up as the one character, you get to dress up as every character during the time that you're reading the book. You know, you get to really kind of, I don't know, fiction is the best invention we have to make it, to understand what it really feels like to be in another person's brain. Like, we can never do that, but we can read, and that provides a pretty good simulation. And it turns out the more you run the simulation, the better you are in real life at doing things involving other people, whether that's a job interview or a first date.
You know, it occurred to me a while ago now, though, you know, when the internet came along, that it was just going to generate so much more writing. And I'm not saying necessarily literary writing or fiction writing, just writing. You know, it used to be before the internet and cell phones and all that, most people would get out of high school or college and they never really write anything ever again unless they wrote a letter or a thank you card or something like that. And now everybody is putting words down out of their brain all day long, every day. What do you think the implications are of that?
That's a really good question. I mean, I've thought about it in terms of reading. You know, I've thought about it in terms of the fact that maybe before the internet there was less reading than we do now. I mean, we're reading emails, we're reading text messages,
yeah.
We're reading
news. But those are all being written by our peers.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm not sure what effect it has on writing. In reading, I know that I've thought about this a little bit. I mean, there's some evidence that we're kind of short-circuiting our reading ability a little bit if we're only reading, and maybe even if we're only writing in these kind of very small, contained and multitasked pockets. You know, multitasking is a hilarious term for me because it doesn't really exist. You don't multitask. Yeah. You don't do things simultaneously. You do one thing, or you read one thing and then you read another thing. And every time you switch, your brain pays a kind of switch cost where you kind of lose focus and lose attention. And so, yes, we're reading a whole lot and we're writing a whole lot. But if it's in this kind of like jumbled, mixed up, multitasked way, then it's really kind of short-circuiting our profound ability to sit and think about something deeply and concentrate and focus for long periods of time. And I guess maybe that's where I'm most worried. I know that, you know, I was on book tour after I published The Nix. I was on a book tour for a long time and I didn't get a chance to write. What I was writing were responses to emails, and I was writing tweets, and I was writing stuff on Facebook, and I was writing responses to readers who nicely reached out to write to me. In other words, I was writing very, very short things for a very, very long time.
Functional
things. Yeah. And then I finally, after about a year and a half, got a chance to go back to start working on the next novel again, and it was so difficult. To sit down for a couple hours and really try to write with any kind of sustained focus.
And that was just with a short break, relatively speaking.
Yeah.
We're basically out of time, but our next guest is a woman who's written a book about the teenage brain. She's a neuroscientist. Have you given much thought to, like, what you were just describing, the possible impact that might be having on our digital natives that are coming up now, the people who, you know, the kids who are my daughter's age, 13, who's always been in this world, you know, where it's kind of an experiment.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I know I've heard some people make the claim that digital natives will, you know, this is only difficult for for old people like us, you know, and that digital natives will find this very, very simple and will go to it very naturally. And I kind of quibble with that a little bit. I think that when I was a kid, I remember that people actually believed that if you grew up and your parents were smokers, if you grew up with smokers, then smoking wasn't as bad for you because you were somehow immune to it. I remember people really believed that.
Like taking small doses of poison.
Yeah, right, exactly, which is hilarious now. But I remember, you know, when I was in second grade, people really believed it. So I wonder if it's the same way today. We think, oh, digital natives are just growing up with it, therefore they're somehow immune. And there's no study that I've seen that shows that. I mean, mostly studies show that the more time you spend reading on screens, the more you're browsing and keyword searching and skipping around and reading in a very kind of skimmy way, whereas the more time you spend reading a page, like analog real paper, mm-hmm. the more you're reading deeply and concentratedly and focusedly. I don't know. I think I still worry about the young kids today.
Well, I think it's all about a balanced diet.
Yeah, you know, I think you're right.
Thank goodness my daughter reads 2 novels a week.
Good
and
for her.
She's on the screen all the time, but you know she's totally addicted to reading real books, mm-hmm. and I think that's really important.
I agree.
Okay, well, that is all the time we have for this part of the show. I want to thank my guest. Nathan Hill is author of the best-selling novel, The Nicks, the second installment of his 4-part lecture series called Everything Old is New Again, What Happens When Literature Goes Digital, is tonight from 6 to 8 p.m. in Sugden Hall, room 114 here on the campus of Florida Gulf Coast University. The series continues the next 2 Wednesdays at the same time. Nathan Hill, thanks for coming in. Great talking to you.
Great talking to you, too.
When we return, we'll meet the author of the best-selling book, The Teenage Brain, A Neuroscientist's Survival Guide to Raising Adolescents and Young Adults. I'm Mike Canary, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.